Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org.
Hello, and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. That sound means we're going to have some fun. After 3 days of fundraising, it's time to have a little bit of fun. And I remember a while ago seeing Friday the 13th coming up on the schedule, and I said to Edgar, we got to do Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. So that's what that music is, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin theme music. It is Friday the 13th, a perfect day. I have no idea how Friday the 13th came to be an odd day or an unusual day, but a perfect day for some Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and a really good fundraiser because we met our match yesterday, and it was close, but a big outpouring at the end of the day. So thanks for everybody. Thanks to everybody for helping us have a successful pledge drive. Hi, Jimmy. Welcome back.
Hey, Si. Thank you. How's it going?
Pretty good. Pretty good. All in all, I'm feeling pretty good. When we meet those goals, that's an awful nice feeling.
It's a big relief.
Yeah.
Something I think people don't realize is how stressful fundraising is for people like you and me.
Yeah, it is. And it's always surprising me how tired I am after it. I'm like, well, it's not like digging ditches or anything, but somehow it takes it out of you. So again, I just couldn't be more grateful. Thank you to everybody. Friday the 13th, I thought it was a perfect day for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
But you don't feel like it's bad luck. You feel like we're okay.
You know, a few years ago, this was when I was living in San Diego. I was doing some redecorating and I went down to a local shopping mall that had an Asian store, like furniture store. Uh-huh. And I went in because I'd seen that they had those food dragons or food dogs that are kind of ornate statuettes made out of something that at least looks like jade. I think they're actually probably just green glass, but they look really cool. And so I wanted to get a pair of them. And so I went into the store and it was run by a very nice elderly Chinese gentleman. And I picked out the food dogs I wanted and I was getting ready to pay for them. And he was telling me all about the proper placement of them in order to ensure good luck. And I explained to him, it's like, I'm not so much a believer in luck, but I don't think I was getting through to him because he kept going about the best place to put him for good luck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to get your placement right. In some cultures, you got to get your placement right or it produces a lot of anxiety. I'm with you. I don't feel too worried on a Friday the 13th or going under a ladder or seeing a black cat.
I've lived through lots of Friday the 13ths.
Yeah, right.
I've never had a problem.
All right. Let me get to some questions here. We've got all the questions are in. Usually people have all kinds of fascinating questions that they will email to Jimmy or get to Jimmy through social media one way or another. And we start with Sophie P., who says, somebody's typing on it while I'm trying to read it. How do we grapple with the Eastern Orthodox theology that aliens would be considered demons? Sophie says, I think the idea is largely from Father Seraphim Rose, although he's quite contentious in Orthodox circles, and I have many friends who dislike him a lot and others who consider him better than basically every saint. All right, Sophie, thank you.
Okay, well, I know just a little about Seraphim Rose. He was an Eastern Orthodox priest in the 20th century. He passed on to his reward in 1982, so he hasn't been with us for a while. And I don't know what he may have said about aliens being demons and so forth. I'm also not sure how common that idea is in Eastern Orthodox circles. I'm pretty sure that none of the individual churches that are part of the Eastern Orthodox Communion have adopted that as an official position. But it wouldn't surprise me that there are individual Eastern Orthodox who have advocated this idea, just like there are, you know, the Catholic Church hasn't adopted this either as an official position, but there are various Catholics who adopt it.
Yeah.
But in terms of how to grapple with the idea that aliens would be considered demons, well, I would simply say the same thing to Eastern Orthodox that I say to Catholics. Where's your evidence? I'm happy to entertain the idea that demons might be masquerading as aliens, and maybe there are no other intelligent beings in our universe, so any apparent aliens are all demons. I'm happy to entertain the possibility, but simply saying it so doesn't make it so. And if you want me to believe something, you need to give me evidence for it. Whoever is making a claim and wants someone else to change their mind, my current mind being, I don't know if they even exist, much less that they're demons. So I'm wide open on this question. But if you want me to change my mind and say, oh, they do exist and they're all demons, well, then you need to give me some evidence. You shoulder the burden of proof for that. And I'm going to be open, but I'm also going to be a little bit suspicious, because there have been loads of occasions in the past where people leapt to the conclusion that demons were responsible for something, and it turned out to be absolutely false. In fact, people have even died because people leapt to the demon hypothesis without sufficient evidence. A while back, I did an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the question of, is it always demons whenever you encounter something you don't understand? And it was episode 188 for people who'd like to look it up. But I began the episode with like six or seven news accounts of children who had been killed accidentally because their parents thought that they were demon possessed. And all of these stories were just from the 2 years leading up to that episode. And what these parents had done, and these were not Catholic exorcisms, but what these parents had done is decided, my 2-year-old's throwing a temper tantrum, they must be demon possessed, and we better do a home exorcism. So we'll just hold our child's head under the water faucet and use hot water to drive the demon out of our child. And multiple children have been killed that way. So that's an illustration of how leaping to the demon hypothesis whenever you don't have sufficient evidence is destructive. So yeah. I would like to see evidence for this. And I would note that I've already got some not conclusive, but notable evidence that points in a different direction from reported alien encounters. Now, I don't know if any of these reported alien encounters actually involve aliens, but what I do notice is that the aliens reported in the encounters don't try to get worshipped as pagan gods. They don't try to possess people. They don't try to spread false theological ideas. So they're not doing the stuff that demons historically have been known to do. And that would point us away from the idea that they're demons if they're not doing demon stuff. So I'm totally open here, but if you want me to believe something, you need to show me evidence. And thus far, I have not seen good evidence on this one. I've seen a lot of claims. And I've even debated the astronomer Hugh Ross, who is an advocate of the alien demon hypothesis. I also have an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World where I go through a book he wrote and critique the arguments that he uses. And I don't find them conclusive, but I'm still open.
Sophie P., thanks very much for the question. Thanks for getting us started. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today for this Friday the 13th. And Jimmy mentioned a couple times Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular documentary podcasts out there. Hundreds of episodes available. If you've never listened, boy, do you have some exciting times ahead of you, because there's hundreds of great episodes. A new one drops each Friday morning. So what dropped this morning, Jimmy, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, I'll let you know. First, though, I want to mention I was just able to look up in what episode do I respond to the arguments that Hugh Ross has used for the demon hypothesis for aliens. It's episode 281. So 281. That was a while back, though. Today, we had episode 404 come out. And unlike on the internet, 404 does not mean that we couldn't find the episode. In fact, we have the episode, and it's about a very well attested ghost story in Tracy, California, up in the Bay Area. There is a essentially today, it's like a bar and grill that has been around since the 1800s. It's called the Banta Inn. And in 1968, the owner of the Banta Inn, one of the owners, passed on to his reward. And subsequently, numerous people, including people who did not know him, reported seeing him and could pick him out of photo lineups. There have been numerous witnesses to his haunting the Banta Inn, and some of the phenomena has even been captured on camera. And so I interview one of the principal investigators of the Banta Inn, and we show you the footage.
Oh, exciting. Check it out at mysterious.fm or on Jimmy's YouTube channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's take a quick break and come back with more weird questions. We got a lot of weird questions. I get to do some reading coming up, and then Jimmy will give us his sometimes weird answers, sometimes not so weird answers. We'll find out right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Check out EWTN's official YouTube channel.
Just follow the link on our homepage at EWTN.com or go to YouTube.com/EWTN.
Watch EWTN's live shows or today's homily from the Daily Mass.
Click the upload button to see our most recent clips.
You can also find all of EWTN YouTube content by clicking the playlist button.
It's all on the official EWTN YouTube channel at YouTube.com/EWTN.
Visit today.
Yeah, you know what that music means when we've got that special theme music playing. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. That's always a fun way to spend a Friday, and that's just exactly what we're doing today. I've got a whole bunch of weird questions in front of me, and I'll pick them out and read them as I go, and Jimmy will give us answers. This one, Jimmy was just telling me, just came in today, and I'm because Thomas knew that we were having weird questions today. So nice, good on you, Thomas, for knowing what was up today. And this is Thomas's question. Hello. Thank you for taking the time to read my email. I watched your video, Could You Marry an Alien? And I found it to be quite comprehensive in answering that question. But now I have a question on whether the exact same principles for real life need to be followed in a fictional story. I've been reading a serialized science fiction story by an Anglican author. In the story, a relationship starts to develop between a human male and a humanoid female alien. I've talked with the author about his plans for the story, and while most of the criteria have been met, being with a rational soul, will be baptized later in the story, the author decided to treat the ability to have children as the same as an infertile human couple. Is that an okay approach for a fictional story, or should real-life principles be applied? He has also discussed another potential solution, potentially objectionable idea, having sci-fi technology be capable of allowing interspecies couples to reproduce. Is this a viable solution, provided that it works like acceptable fertility treatments instead of IVF cloning or any other unnatural intrusion? Or is this also bad? Can the same principles be applied to humanoid fantasy creatures as to aliens?
Okay, so I'm not sure precisely which video of Thomas has watched. I've answered the variations on this question a number of times. But one of the things that I point out, other than I don't know if aliens even exist, which people seem to forget for some reason. one of the things I often point out is there is no definitive answer on this question. It would take an act of the magisterium to answer the question of whether a human could marry an alien and what kind of alien and things like that. So we're in a realm of theological opinion. And some theologians would say that their opinion is if you can't breed together, you're different species and you can't get married. Now, you might be infertile, like two humans who are past the age of childbearing or who have other fertility issues. And you could get married then because you're the same species then. But if you're two fundamentally different species, you shouldn't be getting married, not in the real world. On the other hand, other theologians wouldn't be so quick to say that, because the classic definition of what a human is a rational animal. And any intelligent aliens we found would be rational animals. And so, they didn't know about DNA whenever, and people can have DNA incompatibilities. What they did know about is man is a rational animal. And so if you met an alien that's also a rational animal, from some classic Christian and Catholic perspectives, that would be a man. It might be a man with a different biology than us, but it's the same. It goes in the same category, according to this other opinion, as a human being, because it's another rational animal. And so we shouldn't allow the modern biological definition to trump the philosophical or theological definition of what a human is from this perspective. So I can see theologians going both ways on this. And so that's what I commonly point out whenever I answer this question. When it comes to what Thomas is asking about, if you can, I assume he's exploring the idea of you could marry a rational animal alien in real life. I assume he's exploring that opinion. Could you do the same thing in a fictionalized story? Well, Cy Kellett, why don't you help me out? If you can do something in real life, can you depict it in fiction?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Okay, so yeah. If you could order a pizza in real life, could you write a story about someone ordering a pizza?
You got to start right in on the pizza so early in the show, Jimmy. All right. Yes, fine. You could order a pizza.
Okay. So I would say, given that this is an opinion that some people could hold and it hadn't been condemned by the church, whether you buy that opinion, and I don't know that I do buy that opinion, but it would seem to me that it's defensible. You could mount a defense of it. And so you could explore a defensible opinion in fiction too. So I wouldn't have a problem reading about, Trip Tucker, a human male, marrying T'Pol, a Vulcan female, and, Ambassador Sarek marrying Amanda Grayson and so forth. That happens all the time in fiction, so I don't see a problem with it. Now, Thomas goes on to ask, about reproductive issues. And here, there's a difference in the fictional representations of what happens. In Star Trek, Trip Tucker and T'Pol were not able to have a child without medical assistance. In fact, someone used their cells to come up with a child without their consent even. So that was clearly immoral. On the other hand, we have other hybridizations like Mr. Spock, who seems to, as far as we know, his parents didn't use any kind of medical technology to enable his conception. So it could be that humans and Vulcans sometimes are fertile and sometimes they're not. Well, okay. Thomas's first variation on this question is, could you depict in fiction a human and an alien getting married even though they're not fertile and treat it just like two infertile humans getting married? And my inclination, if we're exploring the path that they can get married at all, would be to say, yeah, if two humans are not fertile together and they can still get married, like because they're past the age of childbearing or they have genetic incompatibilities or they have, you know, medical conditions that prevent them from being able to be fertile, then you could treat a human alien pairing the same way. If it's naturally infertile, but you can otherwise marry someone, then the same thing would apply. He then asks about, well, could you use medical technology to make it possible for them to have offspring? And if you could use medical technology that's licit to use on humans, you could use that same technology to enable a human and an alien to have a baby. On the other hand, I would actually be more concerned about watching or reading a fictional scenario where a human and an alien use medical technology to have a baby, because so many medical technologies like in vitro fertilization and cloning and things like that are not moral for humans to use. And so I would be concerned that in this case, there could be a scandal, meaning tempting someone into sin by making it seem like, oh, if I'm infertile, I can just use IVF or something like that. Right. And so I'd rather see the human and the alien get married and it not be an issue that they have a baby or they're not able to have a baby, rather than getting into the question of could you use medical technology to enable that and what kind of medical technology could you use? Unless you really dig down on that latter question, I would say that you're posing a risk of scandal here. Whereas if they get married and have a baby with no problem, or if they get married and can't have a baby, you're not scandalizing anybody because nobody's going to be marrying an alien in the foreseeable future anyway.
All right, Thomas, thank you very much for getting that question into us. I think we got time for another one before I have to take a break. So we'll go to John's question. John says, I understand vampires to be the antithesis of Christ, consuming blood to give themselves life, whereas Christ shed his blood to give us life. And this makes vampires evil. If they were real, how could they be evil since they would be creations of God? It seems a paradox to me that they would be naturally evil. The evil act of consuming blood is in their nature, while being a creature of God.
Okay, well, so vampires, the way they're depicted in fiction, are humans, at least most of the time. They're humans who have become vampires. And their transition to vampirism requires them to eat blood. So this is, or consume blood. So this is not itself something that's part of their nature. It's something that's been added to their nature due to circumstances. It's kind of like you could have somebody who becomes a drug addict and they become dependent on the drug so that they now must consume this drug in order to survive. Otherwise, let's say they'll have a heart attack and die. Well, it's not their nature as a human to consume this drug, but they have acquired a dependency on it because of circumstance. And in the same way, I would look at a vampire and say, if they were real, their nature as a human does not require them to eat blood, but they have become dependent on the consumption of blood by circumstance. And so this, I would say, would be a physical evil, just like drug addiction is a physical evil. So that's what I'd say as a first pass, but I think there are a couple of other passes here that are worth exploring. Cy Kellett, have you ever been to a swamp?
I've driven by a swamp. I mean,
have you ever been bit by, what do they call those little things that bite you and leave a big kind of red bump on you when they do it? What are those called? Mosquitoes.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever been bit by a mosquito?
Yeah, I have.
Why do you think the mosquito bit you?
I'm delicious, Jimmy. I am delicious.
Your flesh is delicious, or some particular part of you?
They wanted my blood.
They wanted your blood. And so mosquitoes are a creature that does exist in the real world and that is dependent on eating blood and that is a creature of God. And so even though they may be annoying to humans, and even though they can carry diseases that are harmful to humans, mosquitoes are part of God's creation. But there's more to say here, and so we'll finish up on the other side of the break.
I hope we're coming back with a condemnation of mosquitoes, but we'll find out. Jimmy Akin, Weird Questions, Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I mean, mosquitoes are God's creatures. They're God's little creatures. But I would like an explanation at some point.
Okay.
I would like God to explain those mosquitoes to me at some point. But you were talking about vampires, Jimmy, and the mosquito is a vampire, really.
Right. So John was proposing that vampires are an antithesis to Christ. They consume blood in order to get themselves life. Well, mosquitoes do the same thing. And mosquitoes are God's creatures, and they're not intrinsically evil. You know, God didn't make anything that that is evil. And so I think the lesson we can draw from that is that consuming blood is not evil. And it was forbidden for Jewish people to do it as part of the ceremonial aspect of the law of Moses, but other people didn't have a problem eating blood. Now, I personally find the idea of deliberately eating something made with blood gross, but that's because I didn't grow up doing it. Humans have an interesting relationship to what they find palatable and unpalatable. If you, as a child, you know, eat something regularly, you're going to like it. And I saw a great illustration of this a number of years ago. There was a former employee of Catholic Answers, really great guy, who had decided he and his family were going to be vegetarians. Now, he later got a condition that required him to eat meat. So I interpreted that as God is teaching you and you need to go in a different direction now. But during their vegetarian phase, I went over to their house and saw like their 2-year and 3-year old begging for little pieces of lettuce, you know, from a salad. And that would not have happened in the house I grew up in. I mean, we ate salads, but it was not begging food. But in his house it was, because that's what they were used to eating. The thing about humans is we're omnivores. So we can eat almost anything. Not quite as much as if we were from the planet Bismol, where Matter Eater Lad comes from in the Legion of Superheroes, but we can eat a wide range of things. And so the difficulty is we're born at some particular spot on the planet, but in addition to the things we can eat, there are going to be things we can't eat, because some things are poisonous to humans. And babies don't know the difference, you know. And so babies need to be born with their food preferences wide open. Because there's no – your genetic code has no way of knowing which plants locally or which – other things locally would be okay for you to eat or not. You need to be wide open, and the adults around you will get you to eat what is safe. But then as you start growing, you're less dependent on the adults. You start making more of your own decisions. And so at that point, now that you've learned the following foods are okay, you need your food preferences, which were wide open, to become very narrow to just the stuff that you've learned is safe. And that's why kids become picky eaters, because they weren't previously exposed to certain foods. And so now that their food preferences have narrowed to what they have learned is safe, they don't want to eat anything that's not on that list. And it requires effort and training to get them to move beyond what their initial food preferences were from this early phase. So in my house, being an American, we didn't grow up eating anything that was made with blood. But you know who does? Loads and loads and loads and loads of people around the world.
Yeah.
For example, if you go to Asia, they will have hot and sour soup that is made with blood. Now, I love hot and sour soup, but I don't love it if it's made with blood. And I prefer the Americanized hot and sour soup that is blood-free. On the other hand, it's not far off exotic Asia that has blood food products. If you go to England, the principal country that, you know, was involved in the founding of America, they have blood sausage.
That's why we left, and, I think.
Well, could be. But, you know, eating blood is not just for mosquitoes. It's for humans, too. And it's okay because because we're not subject to the law of Moses. You know, nobody is these days. We're not ancient Israelites, and so we're not subject to the law of Moses. But also, in particular, in Mark 7— Jesus makes a point that nothing that enters your mouth makes you unclean. And Mark draws, the inspired author draws the inference, and it, since he's inspired, it's guaranteed to be correct, that Jesus thus declared all foods clean. This was written in an age when people did, who were not Jews, did eat blood just like people do today. So blood is on the approved for humans food list these days. It always has been. It's just that ancient Israelites were not supposed to eat it for ceremonial cleanliness reasons, but or for ceremonial reasons, but we're not subject to that law anymore. So I would say that I commend John for thinking about this issue, but I think I disagree with his premise that that consuming blood would make vampires or mosquitoes or humans intrinsically evil.
John, thank you very much. A perfect question for today. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Here's one from Andrew. I enjoy listening to much of your content. I am wondering, does Jesus genetically resemble God in genotype and or phenotype? How about Mary? Thank you for considering answering my question.
Okay. So Andrew used a couple of words there that most folks aren't familiar with, genotype and phenotype. So we better define those so people will know what we're talking about. A phenotype is what you can say about an organism by observing it macroscopically. So I could look at the organism Cycelet and I could say that Cycelet has gray hair. And it looks like his eyes are blue or green, and he's probably between 5 and 6 feet tall, and you know, he probably weighs more than 150 pounds, but not 250, I would guess.
Yeah, I appreciate that range. Thank you.
Yeah, and so in describing all those characteristics of Cycelet, I'm describing his phenotype. But Cycelet, is your hair current hair color demanded by your DNA?
It
or
is not.
Okay, how about your eye, current eye color? Maybe, that maybe
I,
not.
I,
those
I
eye color can change during life. How about your current height? If you had been nutritionally deprived growing up, would you be the same height?
No, I'd be a different height.
Okay, and how about your weight? If you had been nutritionally deprived, would you be a different weight?
No, it's 100% genes. I had nothing to do with. Yes, that's a right. That's a variable. That one doesn't have to be what it is. Yeah.
So your genotype, that's your genes.
Yeah.
And so this illustrates the difference between what you are on the genetic level, which just is can be effectively described as your genotype versus what you observe when you look at an organism or examine an organism at a particular moment, and that's its phenotype. So here we're asking, do Jesus and Mary resemble God in either genotype or phenotype? So first question. Cycelet. Is God an organism that we can observe and establish a phenotype?
No, he is not.
No. Therefore, prima facie, neither Jesus nor Mary would resemble God in phenotype.
Right.
Okay, now let's look at the other one. Genotype. Does God have a genetic code?
No.
So again, neither Jesus nor Mary would resemble God in terms of genetic code. At least that's how it would seem at first glance. Because God doesn't have a genetic code, and so Jesus can't resemble him in a literal way, but might there be an analogical way that Jesus could resemble God on the genetic level? Well, people have different aptitudes that are based on, in part, on their DNA. Some people, for example, are psychopaths. And psychopathy, which is which involves a dramatic lack of empathy, has a strong genetic component. On the other hand, Jesus, Psychelet, was he a psychopath?
He was not. I feel confident in saying
he was not a psychopath. He went to the cross in order to die for humanity. That displays, to my mind, remarkable empathy. As St. Paul says, you know, someone might dare to die for a just man, but Jesus died for us while we were yet sinners. That's remarkably empathetic. So I would say that is a godly characteristic, though, that self-sacrificing empathy that Jesus displayed.
Right, right.
And so I would say, even though God doesn't have genes, to the extent that Jesus's genes assisted him in manifesting the self-sacrificial empathy that he displayed, that or any other characteristic that was godly that Jesus displayed, that you could analogically say, not that he resembles God in genotype, but that he has elements in his genotype that that enabled him to display characteristics of God in a human way. So I would say that there's a kind of analogical similarity there. God doesn't literally have a genotype, but Jesus had a genotype that enabled him as a human to display certain godly characteristics that did show a resemblance to God.
Andrew, thank you for that fascinating question. That brings us to the break.
Same thing for Mary.
Okay. And Andrew, that'll do it for that. We'll be right back with more Jimmy Akin weird questions. We got a whole bunch of them. Lots more coming up on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley of the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
He was a Jesuit, a cardinal, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Robert Bellarmine is honored for his immense contributions to theology, including helping to draft two important catechisms that defended church teachings during the Protestant Revolt. Pope Clement VIII named Bellarmine a cardinal because, as the Pope put it, Bellarmine had not his equal for learning.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back. Happy Friday the 13th to you. We thought Friday the 13th, at least I thought, be a good day to ask a lot of weird questions of Jimmy Akin. And that is exactly what we are doing today. A whole bunch of weird questions for Jimmy. This one comes from Saberlike 659. Saberlike says, is it okay for one to hold the view that the tree of life from the Kabbalah is a valid conception of God without straying from the doctrinal belief in the Trinity? Like, if God is so beyond the realm of human comprehension, in the sense of the story of the blind men and the elephant, where we as mortals don't possess the capacity to conceptualize God in his totality, is it valid to explore other conceptions of the role God plays in the world without straying into heretical territory, so long as you still hold on to the traditional categorization of the Trinity as well?
Okay, so I definitely agree that we can't fully conceptualize God. He is to use the term from medieval philosophy, he is incomprehensible. We cannot comprehend him. We can't put our intellectual arms around him and figure out everything about God. He exceeds our ability to fully comprehend. But he has revealed to us that he is a Trinity, and we can understand enough about the Trinity to see how that's possible, although it's not something we could deduce on our own. He has to reveal it to us. He has to tell us about it. What about alternative ways of thinking about God? I'll mention this before I specifically get to the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. I think it's certainly possible to have alternative conceptions of God. You do need to hold on to the doctrine of the Trinity because God's revealed that that's true. If you want to use alternative conceptualizations of God, I think that up to a point that can be done because we see that in Scripture. At one point, God compares himself to a king. Jesus, in his parables, compares him to a landowner. The prophets in the Old Testament actually even use feminine metaphors for God sometimes. Like even if a mother can no more forget her children than, even if she did, I wouldn't forget you. Or, delighting in the breasts of God. There's a passage like that. And so like a baby delights in the breasts of its mother. So there are alternative conceptualizations that express truths about God. However, and so those are legitimate. I don't have a problem with those. But I do think that we need to be very careful here, because if we're getting into an area that we don't know that much about, precisely because God is not fully comprehensible. We cannot fully understand God as human beings. And we run a great risk of saying something false about God if we get too adventurous into this territory. Sticking with some, basic metaphors, that's okay. But when we're talking about the Trinity and something on that level, I don't want to move beyond what's safe. Having said that, with that as a caution, what about the Tree of Life from Kabbalah? So people may have seen this. You often see it depicted as a kind of diagram. It does look kind of like a tree. It doesn't have leaves and stuff, but it's got a group of, it's the way it's typically depicted, a group of circles that are connected by lines, and it looks vaguely tree-like. And the different circles, there's 10 of them, they're known as sfirot. And they represent different aspects of God or different divine attributes. And so, God has a number of different divine attributes, and if you can put them together in a kind of schematic that makes sense of how they're connected, that's fine with me. But the way the Tree of Life is commonly understood in Kabbalah, I think there are some problems that I think would rule it out for an Orthodox Christian, because one of the things that Kabbalists will say is that God's, if I can put it this way, his energy sort of moves from one of the spherot to another. And that I'm getting hinky about, to quote Joe Friday, because I think we're at risk of oversimplification and possibly falsification if we're talking about God's energy moving from one of his attributes to another. By the way, the non-Kabbalistic Judaism is sometimes critical of the Tree of Life. And there are even Jews who would say things. And Saber, like 659, makes a good point in talking about it in relation to the Trinity, because there are Jews who have said, hey, we're supposed to be monotheists, and Christians only have three. You've got 10. So that's a source of some dispute in the Jewish community. Having said that, I think we're in an area where we know so little that it's easy to oversimplify or even falsify things. But my real problem is this. In Kabbalah, at least as it's classically understood, the world is broken. Now, that much, duh, look out a window, you can tell that. But in Kabbalah, the explanation for why the world is broken is because of the Tree of Life, that as the energy flows from one spherot to another, it creates so much energy that it causes breakage. And so it's like God can't properly handle all of his own energies, and that results in the world being broken. And so in Kabbalah, one of the big goals and one of the things that humans are supposed to do is participate in tikkun olam, or the repair of the world. So the idea is that the brokenness of the world is something that's intrinsic to the divine nature, and we're kind of here to help God out by repairing the world that is broken because of God's nature. It's like, okay, this articulation of the Tree of Life is not going to fly from a Christian perspective. By the way, Saber-like, if you'd like to learn more about Kabbalah from a including a Christian perspective on it, I've got a couple of episodes of Mysterious World that deal with it. They're episodes 218 and 219, so 218 and 219. In them, I interview a Jewish scholar named Justin Sledge. He's not himself a Kabbalist, but he is very familiar with Kabbalistic thought, and he presents it, and I end up offering some Christian perspective. So check out episodes 218 and 219 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World for more.
Saber-like, thank you very much. A brief question, a short question from Andrew, Jimmy. He wants to know, if there were no fall, would philosophy exist?
Okay, you can help me out with this one. So philosophy, the word comes from root, from Greek roots. Philia means love, and Sophia means wisdom. So if our first parents had never fallen, would humans love wisdom?
Yes.
Yeah,
they
so
would still,
at least if you're defining philosophy based on its word parts, I would say, yeah, philosophy would still exist. In fact, we'd be better philosophers if we had never fallen than we are now. On the other hand, words are not defined simply in terms of where their word parts come from. If they were, then the word nice, which comes from the Latin word necius, would mean ignorant or foolish. You know, necius, it's got that ne, which is a negation on it. And skia, it's from the same root as science or knowing. And so when you tell Missy, that's a nice dress, honey, you would be saying that's an ignorant or foolish dress.
Well, I'm going to keep that in mind. That's going to come in handy.
Yeah, well, you may have your own little mental reservation, but I would suggest she's not going to take it in that sense, because the word nice does not mean ignorant or foolish in colloquial English. And so if you look at philosophy in terms of what it contains a number of subfields, like epistemology, which is the theory of knowledge, how we know things, axiology, which is the theory of moral values, metaphysics, the theory of what is real, and axiology is actually not just moral values, but also aesthetic values, any kind of values. And so, Saikelet, if we had not fallen, would humans think about how we know stuff?
I think we would. I think you still got to think.
And would we think about what are good and bad values?
Yeah, we would. Yes.
And would we think about what's ultimately real?
Yes. And yes, we would. All these things.
Yeah. Right. So I would say that in my view, I would think that, yeah, if we had not fallen, then philosophy would exist, not just in terms of where it came from, but in terms of what it contains, what it in, you know, in the in today's world, I'm sure it would take different forms than the way it's taken in our world. I suspect there would be a lot more consensus in philosophy if we had not fallen. I can't say 100% because we'd still have finite knowledge and and that might lead to some diversity of opinion. But I would say that, yeah, it looks to me like philosophy would still exist.
It'd probably be a little easier. It'd be a little less frustrating for some of us. Maybe.
We'd just be way better at it.
Yeah, way better at it, right. Andrew, thank you very much for the question. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin on this Friday the 13th, and we've got an hour more. Well, we've got hours more of them stacked up, but we've got another hour to get through the ones we've got, and we'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.